Welcome to the Middle of the Air.
Hi, this is Ken Butcher with the Middle of the Air. I'm here today with Dave Richards. He just wrote a book called Swords in Their Hands, George Washington and the Newburgh Conspiracy. And I was reading a little bit about your background. You sound like you have a fascinating background. This is a man that worked in military intelligence. You were studied languages. You taught languages overseas. You got a great background. And now Dave has turned his considerable energies and experience to the study of this little part of history. So, Dave, tell us a little bit about what the Newburgh Conspiracy was.
Sure. The short answer is that it was the closest thing to a military coup that America has ever experienced. After the victory at Yorktown over the British in late 1781, George Washington's officers grew very angry because they weren't being paid by Congress, and they also feared that Congress would not provide them with promised post-war pensions. Mm-hmm. Eventually, their anger grew to such a point that nationalist politicians in Philadelphia who wanted Congress to have more taxation authority realized that they could use the angry army as a weapon to hang over the state legislators' heads to force them, to terrify them into giving Congress real taxation authority. As George Washington later chided Alexander Hamilton, the army is a dangerous instrument to play with.
It really is a dangerous instrument, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fascinated by this little chunk of history in time because, you know, I'm a casual history reader, and coming out of school, you tend to think, okay, we had the Revolutionary War, and then we got ourselves a good Constitution, and then we were off to the races, and that was it. But there was this period of time in between the war and when the Constitutional Congress got together that a lot of it just wasn't clear which way things were going to go.
That's so true. And the Newburgh Conspiracy, interestingly enough, is very connected to the writing of the Constitution. The Newburgh Conspiracy, more than any other event during the Revolutionary War, is what convinced the delegates in Congress that the Articles of Confederation had to be replaced with something stronger. And that something stronger, of course, turned out to be the Constitution.
Right. Now, who was the leader of the Newburgh Conspiracy?
I would say the superintendent of finance, Robert Morris, was certainly one of the top figures involved in the Newburgh Conspiracy. On the military side, you'd have to say General Horatio Gates.
And just what is your sense after studying this? Just how close did we come to the whole thing just falling apart, the whole country?
Well, that's a great question, because the founding fathers really weren't that optimistic about America. They felt that there was a real possibility of a civil war breaking out after the Revolutionary War, because the bonds between the states weren't very firm at that time.
Right.
And Congress wasn't trusted by any of the states, and the states didn't even trust themselves. They fought amongst themselves. So there wasn't really any type of strong union. The bonds, like I said, were not firm.
Right, right. And were there, how would you characterize the factions of the states? Were there the larger states versus the smaller states?
Yes, yes.
Or South versus North? Or how?
Both.
And
large versus small, and the ones in the South versus the ones in the North.
So let's drill down a little bit. Exactly what years are we talking about here?
1770s, 1780s.
Okay. And so how did this whole conspiracy start out?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the Continental Army officers grew angry over not being paid by Congress. This went on month after month and year after year. As a matter of fact, in one letter, George Washington guessed that some of his officers hadn't been paid in 6 years. Imagine fighting for your country's independence for 6 whole years, putting your life on the line all that time and not receiving a single cent of your pay in exchange for your travails.
I thought a lot about that, you know, after reading about this, and how could they afford that? You're just an ordinary guy. You want to fight for your country. You go away. You're away from your family and your farm or business for six. How did people even survive that? It's an amazing feat when you think about
that's it. That's true. Keep in mind that during the Revolutionary War, you had a real divide between the enlisted men and the officers. When I say enlisted men, I mean the privates and the sergeants. The officers tended to come from the wealthier classes, and the privates and sergeants came from the lower classes. There was a real divide in terms of wealth between the two groups. So although the officers lost a lot, most of them were able to survive, but they did have to dig into their savings, what they had, to provide for their families. The privates and sergeants in many ways were even worse off.
Right, because they didn't have anything to fall back on.
Right. They weren't wealthy landowners.
During the war, did the privates get any better or more regular pay than the officers?
No. The whole army was neglected
by
Congress.
And even George Washington was neglected.
George Washington was. He did not accept pay for... He lost a lot of his net worth during the Revolutionary War, but he was a very wealthy man. We don't think of George Washington as being a very wealthy man, but for his day and age, he certainly would be up in the top tier.
Talk about some of the personalities that you came across when you were studying for this.
Well, one of the most important figures in the Newburgh conspiracy was a major named John Armstrong. And that name may ring a bell to some of your history buffs, because later he became Secretary of War, and during the War of 1812, he was a very important figure. Armstrong wrote a very incendiary address called the Newburgh Address. Actually, he wrote two. The first Newburgh Address is the one that gets most of the attention from historians. And basically, this was an ultimatum to Congress. He told his officers in this address that they should send just one more petition to Congress. And in the petition, say, pay us or else. If you don't pay us, Congress, we have two alternatives. If peace arrives and we, the army, still haven't been paid, then we will refuse to give up our arms. In other words, we have the ability to march on Philadelphia and get justice at the ends of our bayonets. If, on the other hand, the war continues and peace does not arrive, we can turn our backs on the country and let the British march on Congress and take care of the delegates. That address, needless to say, really agitated the officers. And when Washington got his hands on a copy of it, he realized that the powder keg was about to blow up and he better do something, or the young American Republic might be a thing of the past.
And how did he find out about it, Washington?
He received copies of it. There were many copies of the Newburgh conspiracy made, and fortunately he got his hands on one copy, or maybe even more than one copy.
And the name Newburgh, that comes from?
Newburgh, New York.
New York.
About 50 to 60 miles from New York City, up in the Hudson Highlands.
And this was a military establishment, a fort?
George Washington's last headquarters were in Newburgh, New York.
Okay.
The troops, for the most part, were located in New Windsor, New York, which is very close to Newburgh. It's a matter of just maybe several miles away from Newburgh, New York. New Windsor, New York is also up in the Hudson Highlands. And there were thousands of troops up there. By this time, most of the troops were in the Hudson Highlands. There were some down south, but not too many. Most of them were up north by then.
Okay. And then, so you mentioned this is, I was thinking this was after the active part of the war.
That's correct. That's correct.
So clarify what they were talking about. If peace breaks out, then we'll follow one course. If the war continues, we'll follow another. Were they not clear in their minds at that time?
They weren't 100% clear. There were a lot of rumors of peace. The British, after the loss at Yorktown, had soured on the war, mm-hmm. and it was a matter of time before it came to an end. But this was the day and age when we didn't have the internet. Communications were very slow,
sure.
and all they had were rumors. So George Washington still had to keep his troops on the alert. They had soldiers doing guard duty, and they were drilled. But there were a lot of rumors that peace was on the horizon.
So there wasn't, at that time, a signed, know what you call the document at the end of a war.
A peace treaty.
There wasn't.
Not at the time of the Newburgh conspiracy.
Was there eventually?
There was. And that came just a little bit later. Keep in mind that the Newburgh conspiracy, the height of the Newburgh conspiracy was in March 1783. Mm-hmm. And the victory at Yorktown was back in the fall of 1781. So a lot of time elapsed between those two important events.
Did you get the sense from what you read in your research that Washington felt sort of personally betrayed by some of the men in this conspiracy?
Well, I wouldn't say betrayed. He was certainly angry. And I don't want to go into all the details, because if people want to read the book, I'd spoil much of the story if I revealed how he ended the conspiracy.
Okay.
But what he did was he appealed to their sense of public virtue. Mm-hmm. He spoke to his officers and he said, look, I know what you've gone through. I've suffered during this war. I've gone without pay. I've endured the food shortages, the clothing shortages. I can empathize with you, but you have to give Congress time. It's a big deliberative body, and it works very slowly. You will eventually be treated justly. You will get paid. Just give Congress more time. That's what he urged them to do. And there are some other things he did that I don't want to go into detail on, but his approach to solving the problem, to ending the conspiracy, turned out to be quite successful.
When you were doing your research, were there any personalities that came up that you really admired?
Oh, George Washington, without a doubt.
That was my other question. Everyone admires George Washington going in. How did your attitude picture of him change as you did this research?
That is a great question, because I have heard on TV so many times historians say, well, Benjamin Franklin would do real well in this day and age with the internet and all the inventions, and Thomas Jefferson, he would also do really well because he was a very intellectually curious person. But I came away from this project convinced that George Washington would do very, very well in this day and age, because he was a person with a great deal of common sense, and he had an incredible ability to keep his passions in check. He wrote down these rules of civility and decent behavior in company and conversation, and one of them was, in all causes of passion, admit reason to govern. He felt you had to keep your passions in check, and he especially feared the passion of anger. He mm-hmm. felt that if you were angry, you were prone to do really bad, dangerous things.
And what was his temper like? Did he get angry and then settle himself down? Or do you think he never reached those peaks of anger in the first place?
He could get angry, but he had an ability to control his anger. He didn't let it rule him. He controlled his emotions.
So what these men were doing at Newburgh, would that have been considered by some treasonous?
Oh, I think in this day and age, many people would consider that type of action treasonous.
Are generals that would have just come in with an iron fist and started hanging people.
That's probably true. If Washington hadn't been the commander-in-chief, it's very possible that there would have been some courts-martial and even executions, but Washington was able to end the conspiracy without executing anybody or trying anybody by court-martial, which is good. He understood that their complaints were justified, but he also understood that they couldn't go through with this ultimatum, that they had to trust Congress.
What do you think if they had sent an ultimatum to Congress? What do you think the result would have been?
I think Congress probably would have deliberated and deliberated and deliberated, and nothing would have been done.
I think that's a pretty good guess.
Because Congress was very, very divided back then. We think of Congress being divided today, but it was as divided, if not more so, during the Revolutionary War. You had on the one side the nationalists. They wanted Congress, the national government, to have broad taxation authority. They wanted it to be very powerful. And then on the other side, you had delegates who were state sovereignty types. Now, note that I did not say states' rights. I said state sovereignty types.
Right.
They really believed that each state was sovereign. And they did not trust the national government, Congress. They wanted the power of the purse strings to be held by the state legislatures.
Right. So, you know, the other thing that occurred to me about this period of time that it's easy for us to forget. You know, you're talking about how Congress worked or didn't work then versus now. Now, at least, we're coming from a place where we take for granted, or it has been proven, that our form of government works. Back then, there were plenty of people. This was a new thing on the earth. And there were plenty of people that did not believe that you could send a bunch of representatives into a Congress and rule a country like that. So that was also in the background here. Is that right?
Without a doubt. They saw that what they were doing was something very new and very important for the rest of history, for all of mankind. They really believed that they were doing something noble and good, and they hoped that it would work. But they weren't overconfident. The men like George Washington didn't think, oh, this will definitely work and we won't have problems. They realized that it was going to be a tough go for them.
Right. I even remember, skip ahead to the future, I remember hearing some Abraham Lincoln talking during the Civil War. And, you know, everything's at stake in the Civil War, including what was one of the things that was on his mind was, basically, if we don't make this work, if we let this country fall apart, we're not just letting this country down and ourselves down. We're letting the whole world down. It'll confirm people's ideas that this form of government doesn't work. So it wasn't, you know, as if there wasn't enough at stake already. You have that whole conceptual thing and the whole future of the world in the balance.
Right. And in that regard, Washington was similar to Lincoln.
Yeah, I believe so. I always felt like, you know, reading history, I'm a technologist, so I look at inventions and I think, well, if Alexander Graham Bell hadn't invented the telephone, then someone else would have. And not to take anything away from his work, but on the other hand, there are certain figures in history that almost seem irreplaceable, and it seems to me Washington was one of them.
That's a good point. As a matter of fact, there's a great biography written about Washington titled The Indispensable Man by James Thomas Flexner, and if you want to read just one biography of George Washington, I would recommend that one.
Okay. Say that again.
The Indispensable Man by James Thomas Flexner.
I that's exactly what we were talking about. I like the title. So let me shift gears a little bit here and ask you sort of about your process of researching this book, of writing this book. Was it? I'm interested in what that looked like. Did you do all the research and have this gigantic pile of stuff and then start outlining and writing, or did you do it, were you researching and outlining and writing all concurrently?
The latter. However, some historians do choose the former course. They will do all their research and then the writing. I think for me that would have been very difficult.
It seems like if you tried to do it all up front, then you'd end up with... Or it seems like once you start writing or once you start outlining, you would realize, oh, there's a hole here. I don't know who that did that or what happened there. And you have to go back and look at it again.
That's an excellent point. As I was doing this, I felt like I was putting together a jigsaw puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd do some research, do some writing, and then I'd realize that there was a gap. And mm-hmm. I had to fill in that gap. So I'd do more research. And I'd get what I was looking for and mm-hmm. move on to the next period that I was covering.
And how do you organize this kind of information as you're... You must have had a good filing system where you were categorizing things under people or time periods or subjects, or how did you do that?
Well, I wanted to do this as chronologically as possible. So I was always thinking in terms of the month and the year.
Okay.
And
did you have a big graph on the wall or anything like that?
No, I did end up having to write an outline. As a matter of fact, one of the big mistakes I made when I first started working on this project is I tried to do the research and writing without an outline.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up with way too much material.
Mm-hmm.
The outline forced me to reduce what I had to the point where I could come up with a cohesive story mm-hmm. that could be read.
Okay. And over what period of time did this project go on?
I spent about 8 years on this project. Now, there were some breaks during that period.
Mm-hmm.
But even if I had not taken breaks, I would have spent at least 3 years of work every day, mm-hmm. many hours a day. More likely, though, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way I could have finished something like this in a year or two.
Well, this is a considerable piece of work here. This isn't a little pamphlet we're looking at, ladies and gentlemen. This is a real book. And speaking of the book itself, I just wanted to compliment you or whoever did the cover design. I mean, it sounds like a trivial thing, but that's when I met you at the Blue Ridge Book Festival. I looked at this book and I immediately liked it. I immediately told me what time period I'm looking at between the charcoal drawing and the red script letters that's in it. It just really grabs the eye.
Well, my publisher deserves credit for the front cover. He designed that himself. He didn't outsource that project. He's got a good knack for figuring out what covers will attract people.
I think he did a great job with this. And like I said, it might sound like a trivial point, but I think it's important. It certainly gets across the flavor of it, I think.
Right. Well, you're correct. The front cover is very important. If you want to get noticed by reviewers, you better have a quality front cover.
Now, about the structure of the book, can you talk a little bit about that? Because I wondered if you gave any thought to what might be called a dramatic arch in the story, or did that just occur naturally from what happened in history? Did you think about sort of building up to a crisis point and then the resolution? Or
that's an interesting question, because for some reason a movie popped into my head when
right.
I first started this project, and the movie had nothing to do with the Revolutionary War. It was a movie titled Veronica Guerin.
Right.
And Veronica Guerin starts with her murder.
Okay.
And then they go back in time.
Okay.
And they sort of circle around, and at the end of the film, you see the murder again,
mm-hmm.
but more parts of it. And I thought, because I knew how the story ended, I knew the climax. I felt it would be really effective to start with the climax and then go back in time
uh-huh.
and give people the background they need to understand the story. So you have this situation where chapter one opens with the events of March 15th, 1783, and then I go back to the beginning of the war and explain what the financial situation was. And I then tell how the army grew angrier and angrier as time passed because it wasn't being paid.
Right.
And how creditors, public creditors, too, were not being paid back by Congress.
Right.
So you had two very angry groups, mm-hmm. public creditors who weren't getting what they were owed, and the soldiers and officers in the Continental Army. And one other thing I should mention is the officers had another fear. They had been promised post-war pensions by Congress.
Right.
And they knew if Congress couldn't get its financial act together that they weren't going to get those post-war pensions.
Right. Right. And that's, we look at how we treat our veterans today, and unfortunately it looks like we have a long history of not doing as well by them as they do by us sometimes.
Oh, sure. The VA scandals have been in the news for quite a while. Once in a while we still hear about them. And back during Washington's time, the issue was pay, not being paid by Congress.
Well, let me ask you, for this is going to just jump right out at any history buffs that see this book and read about it. But if you're just a casual reader like myself that reads all kinds of things and only occasionally history, or maybe even if you don't read a lot of history and might want to jump into that, are there any popular sort of recent history books that you could recommend to a reader like that?
Well, I'll go back to the James Thomas Flexner biography of George Washington,
okay.
The Indispensable Man. I think that's a great book for everybody to read because it's the type of book that you could enjoy if you had a PhD in history,
mm-hmm.
or if you had just a high school diploma.
Mm-hmm.
It's really written for everybody, in my opinion. Obviously, it would help if you were interested in the Revolutionary War or George Washington. But you wouldn't need to be a scholar to get through that book.
Sometimes, I can just say from my point of view, sometimes you don't know you're interested in something until you come across a book like that.
Right.
And read it. I mean, I know just to give an example, I go to the Sandberg House quite often since I moved here, hike there a lot and everything, and I thought, well, I really ought to read something by Sandberg. And then I decided to read his biography of Lincoln. And I thought, well, I'll just kind of plod through this, and then I can say I read something about Sandberg. Well, that reads like a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And it got me interested in Lincoln. It got me interested, therefore, in the Civil War. And then I read a lot about the Civil War. So and you never know where these paths are going to take you once you take the first few steps down them.
That's so true. That really is.
Okay.
I never thought I'd be writing about the Newburgh conspiracy. I just stumbled upon that subject.
How did you first find out about the Newburgh conspiracy?
That's also an excellent question. I was reading a book about the writing of the Constitution, and at one point in the book, the authors talked about how important George Washington's presence at the Constitutional Convention was. His presence was important not because he was actively deliberating. He wasn't. He was just there sort of as a figurehead. I don't like using that word, but I can't think of a better word to use. However, his presence was so great that it sort of forced everybody to come up with something better than the Articles of Confederation. He was so respected that they absolutely believed they had to come up with something better than the Articles. And they then pointed to how he had snuffed out the Newburgh conspiracy as an example of how he used the respect he commanded to do good things. The authors devoted only a paragraph of that book to the Newburgh conspiracy, but as soon as I finished reading it, I realized that is a really important event.
So had you heard about it before that?
No. I had never heard of the Newburgh conspiracy before I read that book.
And then you read a little more about it and got more deeper into it?
Well, not exactly. I immediately thought of the possibility of a book.
Uh-huh.
But I had a feeling that someone probably had written a book devoted solely to the Newburgh conspiracy. But when I did research on the internet, I quickly realized that no one had ever devoted a whole book to the Newburgh conspiracy.
Right.
that really pleased me because I had had some false alarms. I was looking for something to write about, and I thought I had something when I heard about the Navajo code talkers during World War II and found out that there had been at least two books written about them.
Right.
But the Newberg Conspiracy, for some reason, was not something that historians felt deserved a whole book, and I did.
Well, great. Well, Dave, thanks so much for doing this interview today. I want to ask you, for people that hear this, want to follow, like, what events you're going to or anything new coming up in your writing life, what's the best way to do that? Is your website?
Sure. I have a website. You can visit it. It's at www.swordsintheirhands.com, www.swordsintheirhands.com. And one of the pages is devoted to events and appearances. And another page has a contact submission form. If you want to reach me, you can fill out that form and it'll go to my email box and I'll be glad to respond.
Okay. Thanks very much, Dave. I hope you do really well with this book and your next project, too.
Thank you for the interview, Ken. I enjoyed it very much.
Thanks again for listening. To listen to other episodes or to sign up for a subscription, you can join us at our website, themiddleoftheair.com. And a special thanks to the Henderson County Public Library for letting us record this session there.